Edward Petherbridge has now been on the stage for almost 60 years, and he's chosen to share some of his experiences with the world in a new book entitled Slim Chances. This covers everything from early days in working class Bradford through a brief spell in prison into a career on stage, screen, and he's actually going off after this interview to act as Tiresias in Antigone, I think. Edward, welcome to Theatre Voice.
Well, thank you.
Right. First of all, what was the motivation behind writing the book? It's obviously a big book. It looked as if it started out as an autobiography and then it kind of moved on to other things.
Well, I always thought it would be a compilation of essays. So even the autobiographical stuff is in the form of self-contained essays. There are a few cross-references from one essay to another, which may mean that you have to read it in chronological order, I think they say. But it can be dipped into, too. It started to get unwieldy, and so I thought, well, I'll never make this into a sort of seamless book. It'll be a collection of essays, and some are personal and autobiographical. And as you rightly point out in your review of it, it gets less personal as it goes on into the theatre, where it is more about the difficult state of being, which is trying to be an actor.
Well, you've succeeded in being an actor. I think about trying to be an actor.
Well, one is always on the block every time one goes on stage, you know. I feel particularly that playing Tiresias at the moment is a frightfully difficult part. Difficult part in a wonderful, wonderful play, but hard to get right. But one has found things hard to get right before, and one will again, I suppose. Yeah.
You decided you wanted to be an actor, and I think decided is probably the right word, at a very early stage of life.
Yes, I could, as I say in the book, I'm in danger of quoting myself.
No, please quote yourself.
I'm in danger, well, because it's such a long book, I shall probably misquote. No, I could take you to the seat, possibly, in the Bradford Lambra balcony, Bradford, Yorkshire. I think it was on the third row, just behind the Limelight Man. I was fascinated by the Limelight Man and all his coloured gels. And there I saw Norman Evans, the famous pantomime dame, in Humpty Dumpty, I think it was. And to quote myself, I was seven. It was the best view of Bradford from that gallery seat that I'd ever had. And I thought that this real but make-believe world was rather attractive.
And presumably there was no family connection with the stage at all? Or with
acting. No, this is not unusual, of course. Artists and writers and all manner of artists and writers and musicians come. I mean, Delius himself came out of a wool merchant family in Bradford, German. In fact, he used to, as a young man, when he was slaving away in his father's office, used to turn an exact corner that I turned in Bradford on my way to drama school. So there's no accounting for it, is there? I mean, Shakespeare's dad was a glover.
I'm just reading Jonathan Cole's biography of John Gielgud at the moment, and if ever a man came from theatrical stock, he was the one.
Exactly.
Everyone.
Exactly, and the Red Graves, of course.
Yes.
And,
so it does cut both ways.
It cuts both ways.
But you must have shown incredible determination, because to be at school in Bradford with family, no interest in acting, and then to decide you wanted to do it, and then by the time you were 17, you were acting professionally.
Well, I was at drama school at the age of 17, but I was certainly farmed out to be in my first my first professional production for a week, and another odd week here and there. I suppose I was really solidly acting in the third year of that drama school when I was 18 going on 19. And the principal of the drama school formed a children's theatre called the Northern Children's Theatre. And we played in very big theatres, variety dates all around the country in the daytime. And spent most of our time in railway sidings and railway cuttings and moving scenery. And the play was a blessed interlude in between.
Did it ever occur to you that you might not have a career, or you were just successful from such an early stage and kept in work, very little time resting, that...
I wasn't successful from an early stage. There's a boy who's playing... I don't know him by his first name. Doug. He's playing Therese's blind... The blind Therese's guide.
Mm.
He's 15, and he's one of the boys. We have to have two. So they can do alternate
yes.
blocks of shows. And he wants to be an actor, and he's got the same blind faith that it's going to be all right for him as I had. If one knew what will lay ahead, one would any of us be able to do anything? it was tougher. That horrible, rich desert called Weekly Rep, where you do a play on Monday night for the first time, and on the Tuesday morning you're not reading your notices. You're busy learning the next one. And so it goes on week by week.
But Weekly Rep no longer goes on.
No, our director of Antigone, Tom Little, has worked at the only Weekly Rep left in England, which I think is in... somewhere like Frinton.
We shouldn't be laughing at Frinton, should we?
No, especially if they've got a weekly rep. Mm. There's nothing laughable about it at all. And so he's experienced that.
Mm.
And then I did one or two rather relatively grand number one tours, as they're called, mm. going to the big number one dates. Cicely Cornish was your older listeners will remember. Dame Cicely Cornish. Jack Hulbert and Robson Hare took a play that had been in the West End mm. out on tour. They kept their starring parts and we filled in the support. And so that was my first experience of, almost my first experience of working with stars and people who could really cut the mustard, I suppose.
Not too long after that, you ended up at the Old Vic with the man who would become Lord Olivier, who, again, I think fully qualifies as a star.
I think he does, yes.
How did that come about?
Well, it just shows how important chance is. I had actually found myself playing in a play in the West End, very briefly. Didn't do very well in the West End. It was a big hit at the Mermaid Theatre with Bernard Miles. And we weren't doing very well. On the stage door notice board one night as I was leaving, I saw an advertisement for something called the Royal Court Studio for acting classes. And it was actually funded by a Gulbenkian grant to the Royal Court. Not many Royal Court... Some Royal Court actors turned up, but mostly sort of waifs and strays, hoping to learn something and pick something up. And William Gaskell, Bill Gaskell, was one of the tutors who was by that time a director at the Royal Court and also at the National Theatre. I don't know how I had time to do it, actually. But he got me on audition for the National Theatre. It was an extraordinary event because they really took their auditions very seriously. And Olivier was there, all the other directors, John Dexter, Bill Gaskell, all the associate directors, certain members of the station management team. And so it was quite an audience. And I was doing something which was comic, so I had to actually wait for the laughs. Not wait for them to come, but wait for them so I could deal with them. And that was rather lucky. And then I heard that I was... going to be offered the princely sum of £18 a week plus a pound of performance, so I made about £21 a week for a bit. It was quite a decent wage then. In 1964, the centenary year of Shakespeare, and I was in, the first thing I was in was Olivier's centenary performance, as it were, Shakespeare's quacentenary performance,
yep,
of Othello. I had two lines. And then I was in the Royal Hand of the Sun with perhaps 15 lines, a lot of makeup and feathers, and understudying Robert Stevens's Atahualpa. I can still do you a bit from that if you like. Cori, cori, atixi, atixi, cori, caranactura, carica, caranactura, carica. It was an invented language. Nobody knows what the Inca sounded like because their civilization was so ruined. Inca! And so on. And we know, and the wonderful composer who composed all this, Mark Wilkinson, was an inspired slave driver of the Inca chants and toil songs. And I played the wretched high priest of the sun for 4 years. 4 years in repertoire. I mean, amongst other things. And that's why I remember that. And that's why I remember Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead. I remember whole chunks of it, particularly from the player, who I used to listen to his big tirades, of course, as Guildenstern.
And you, in a sense, created Guildenstern.
Well, it had been
this
created.
This Guildenstern, anyway. Oh, right.
It had been created by some amateur student actors in a church hall in Edinburgh on the Fringe. There's a complicated history to that, which we won't go into, but I didn't see it. But it was seen by Bill Bryden, the then critic of The Observer. And Kenneth Tynan, saw his review, which was a rave review.
Mm.
You will remember I wrote about the extraordinary story, Tom Stoppard leaving Edinburgh with his tail between his legs, having seen this ill-attended, not specially inspired production of his play, dare I say, I don't know, I didn't see it. Although I have met, through the years, two people who were involved with it. One of them had become an antique dealer and the other, I forget. Anyway, he opened The Observer to see if he could find a review for his book, his novel.
Mm-hmm.
And fell upon this rave review, this life-changing review for his play. And before long, Tynan had zapped out to Edinburgh, I think, or he got out of a coffee, and the National Theatre bought it. And then I was actually handed a copy of the play by Laurence Olivier, who just said, marvellous part, marvellous play.
And he was right on both counts.
Yes.
What was it like to act in it? Because audiences must have, to start with, must have taken a bit of time to kind of tune in.
No, they didn't, actually.
Really?
And in those days, we didn't have time to tune in ourselves. Those days, these are the days of long preview periods, you know.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Then we used to do a public dress rehearsal where people didn't pay.
Mm.
But it was usually full at the Old Vic. And then that was on a Monday night. And then on Tuesday night you opened to, well, the world's press or anybody from the press that was there, which was usually a lot of people. And that was the press night. And that was make or break, I suppose. Extraordinary, really. And I remember there were people who had the difficulties with the play, but I just remember the gales of laughter. I mean, planning a comic performance now, you sort of ease into it over previews, you know, and hope to. But I mean, Olivier always used to say he didn't like a lot of previews because he said, the trouble is with a lot of previews, by the time you've done 4 or 5 or 6, the staff, the people supporting the show technically know exactly what they're doing.
Mm.
And the actors are the only ones who are nervous. And he liked everyone to be in the same boat of nerves.
Was it a very difficult piece to learn? Because it's very wordy.
Yes, I don't suppose it has more words than any other play, except that you get to say a lot of them. It's just you and Guildenstern. Mm. Rosencrantz, I beg your pardon. This is a mistake they make. a lot of the time it's only you. And, well, my mind and memory were younger then. And it must have been difficult. But I don't remember. I remember, I've always found memorising. I think acting would be a wonderful job if only we didn't have to learn lines. Eventually, of course, you'll have them inserted in your brain with a chip, by chip or something. God, no, whether they'll put the interpretation and the motivation there as well, I don't know. I hope not. But that magic moment when it's really, the text is really possessed by, you can say, the best way is to be able to say it without thinking. Then you can start to think, you're free to think and feel when it's an automatic thing. Then you can pretend to make it spontaneous.
Which must be difficult without much of a rehearsal period.
We had...
rehearsal and preview period.
Yes, we had 6 weeks, which seemed luxurious then in those days. I suppose that's what people have now, 4 to 6. But then, they have... The trouble is, previews tend to... They tend to be still getting the set right and the lighting right. And you go in every day to rehearse the set and lighting and do a little titch here to this scene, little titch there. So you go on to the stage in the evening in the preview period with a head full of recent notes and changes and so on. It's hell. Can be hell. Sorry.
And moving on, deciding to walk away from Olivier and the National must have been a major decision.
I didn't decide to walk away. I was there 6 years. Mm. And we were all given eventually people were given their marching orders or their walking orders or their thank you very much. I could have stayed on because they wanted to keep Rosencrantz and Guildenstern on. But I was, I don't know, I'd somehow sort of fallen out of favour, I think. And although I was still playing to the massive houses in this play, and they wanted to keep it on, they didn't want to give me anything especially wonderfully new. Mm. So I remained on friendly terms with Olivier. I've got a little stash of letters from him, and he included me in lists for a house party now and again. And I see from the archive at the British Library that he kept even my bread and butter letters of thanks, but perhaps he kept everybody's bread and butter letters of thanks. Thank you very much. And so it was a strange relationship with him, but he got a bit wonky at one stage. He even sacked his long, long, long faithful Diana Boddington, who eventually became OBE'd for her services to stage management. She was sort of cub mistress sort of person. And he sacked her and reinstated her all in the period of a fortnight, just around the time that I was falling out of favour. And she was still at the National in the new building when I went there years later. In fact, I remember her saying, coming, half an hour, please, company, half an hour. Stand by, beginners, or whatever it was, I forget the call. But it was something like The Way of the World. Stand by for the Way of the World. And then a minute too late, she said, I'm so sorry, I mean School for Scandal. I don't know if those are the two plays, but she certainly got the play wrong.
Mm. Must be a little off-putting for the actors, I would have thought.
Well, they didn't sort of think, my God, are we doing that? I don't know. They didn't think that. I think they knew she was becoming eccentric. Well, she'd always been eccentric.
Is that when you and Ian McKellen set up the Actors Company?
Well, that was set up in 71, 72, 2 years after I left the National. And then we had a company together at the National, which was called the McKellen Petherbridge Company.
Right, yes.
Strictly in alphabetical order, you understand. Unfortunately, I haven't landed the part of a wizard in any great film, so the McKellen Featherbridge Company sounds in the right order in all ways now. But yes, we worked together a lot. We tended not to do scenes together so much because we were in the Actors' Company. We usually our notoriety was spread out, so that we didn't. How do I put this? I would perhaps play a leading part in one play, and you'd play a leading part in another.
And the Actors' Company both was a kind of cooperative. Is that a fair term? I can't think of a better one. So
well, no. Well, it was quite different in those days. There was a lot of funding about, and there was arts funding to tour that the Cambridge Theatre Company had. They had a budget to tour, and there was something called DALTA, the Dramatic and Lyric Theatres Association, which had a mission to fill up the Leeds Grand and the Manchester Opera House and the Oxford New and so on with classy product. And Ian already was a classical actor of young classical actor of some notoriety and had been asked to do something for the Edinburgh Festival. And he sold them, as it were, this idea of an Actors' Company. And he said, I don't know what we'll do because that's down to the company to decide. I'll have one vote, which he did, of course. And but we were taken under the wing of the umbrella company of the Cambridge Theatre. In fact, the Cambridge Theatre Company tried to put its posters up all over the place when we wanted Actors' Company posters up. That's quite a mission. But we didn't do very frightfully well. I mean, nowadays, Felicity Candle was in the product company, and Sheila Reid, Ian, Robin Ellis, who eventually played Poldark. I mean, on television terms and film terms, we would have been a draw now, but then those things hadn't happened to those actors, and so we were just in a rather good company. Yeah. And we got glowing reviews, but modest audiences in these big theatres. But we did very, very well at Wimbledon, where we had our London showing, as it were, and even got invited to New York on the strength of our notoriety, and did the whole repertoire of 2 years' worth of plays, including a review I had devised, which was about four or five productions. We took them all over. I mean, incredible now. We were in a 2-year-old company, and we were in a season which was an English season, in which the Young Vic and the RSC were featured. So we were doing rather well.
And the RSC takes us on very nicely to perhaps the next stage of your career. And I have to say my fondest recollections of you in performance are playing Newman Noggs in Nicholas Nickleby, but you did a lot more at the RSC than just that.
Yes, but that's what people in a certain age bracket remember. And quite rightly, it's such a wonderful theatrical event. I sometimes think what effect it must have had on the children, the young children who were taken to it as their first theatre treat.
Yes.
If I was impressed by Norman Evans and Humpty Dumpty, what must have become of them?
Indeed, yes.
After seeing 8.5 hours of Nicholas Nickleby.
I would think they were blown away, probably, in every sense of the words.
Probably never recovered.
And what was it like to be part of that?
It was
you said it's so all-encompassing, all-embracing.
I know. It was sometimes rather like being a cart horse on May Day. And the cart horse, of course, has got shiny horse brasses and ribbons in its tail and mane. But it's just plodding.
I would say it also might be a bit like being a steeplechaser getting very close to winning the Grand National.
Yes. On the other hand, when new one was in a Thalabed production to continue the rather laboured... it was, of course, wonderful in retrospect. These things are always more wonderful in retrospect than they are at the time. It had its high moments, of course, but as is famously known, people didn't book for it to begin with very much. And we played, we continually asked the audiences to come down and get near us because they were spread about. And then there was a famous review in the Times by, I'm going to forget his name.
Irving Wardle?
No. He was a pundit and a political writer too. Rather conservative and... anyway, he wrote a wonderful review and suddenly the tide turned. Just in one review. In this, I don't know that it would happen now, I don't know. But then, you know, one remembers New York and that extraordinary hothouse rock of Manhattan. The yellow cab driver winding down his window to say, "You guys are great!" And it's not the sort of reaction one would expect in London. And it was terribly hard on sleep, both in the street and in the theatre.
But that, I suppose Dickens himself was a popular writer, so...
Yes.
Dickens would go out and he would tour the States talking to people, and it probably was the equivalent to the cab drivers back then.
Yes, yes indeed. And the people on the quayside waiting for the latest episode of Curiosity Shop.
Yes.
Calling across the water, "Is little Nell still alive?"
Did you enjoy your time at the RSC?
Well, I had various times. I most enjoyed playing Master Ford. That I don't know why Master Ford. I suppose it's not a very clever name for a character.
This is Merry Wives of Windsor.
Merry Wives of Windsor. People think Master Ford of Windsor. They remember Falstaff, but Master Ford is a wonderful jealous husband who strips the laundry bag basket clean when he's looking for Falstaff. But too late. It was the last time he passed through. And that's a wonderful, wonderful diatribes of jealousy and vituperation and... what's the other word? Hyperbole. if people say there's no, you know, don't overact, don't use hyperbole, don't use rhetoric, Shakespeare's characters, when they're in comic or jealous extremis, from Othello to Master Ford, use the most extraordinary, elaborate language that they pluck out, and it's all completely real and passionate. And I love playing. I'd always rather worried about Malvolio. I'd seen it degenerate into a comic term too often. I mean, I love comic terms, but possibly not a very good comic term always. And so I... But I realised that it was... Well, there is a real man, of course, there. And he is a comic turn, but he's also a real man one starts to care about.
I think he probably is best played seriously. The people who play him most seriously are the ones who...
Yes,
have
I mean...
the best effect.
I have plenty of comic business, I have to say. But... but he takes himself very seriously,
yes.
That's the point. And that's his tragedy. To think, he actually thinks, he falls for it, that they convince him that Olivia is in love with him.
Yes. And then I'll talk about two different lawyers, one probably more successful than the other. I suppose one wasn't a lord. Two particular posh people were more successful than the other, forgive me. So, Lord Peter Wimsey.
Yes.
That was your, if I call it your major TV breakthrough, is that a reasonable statement?
Yes, I saw a breakthrough and then broke out. I don't think it was ever repeated. I have various TV roles in the archives that nobody knows about now. I was particularly fond, if you can say fond, about a play that was set in the First World War, Journey's End, which I played a character called Uncle. And that was rather important, and I played that with alongside Jeremy Northam, one of his first major parts on television. Peter Wimsey in the Dorothy L. Sayers Mysteries is still a sort of cult DVD item, and people ladies of a certain age, or even, well, of course out of a certain age, what it is always, but they seem to be in love with him, stroke me, while dimly realising that perhaps I don't look quite the dashing young man. Yes, I was called the thinking woman's crumpet at one stage by a rather distinguished lady I forget the name of. That was rather good.
Yes, well, not a bad epitaph, I would have thought.
No, not bad.
And you did quite a lot of seasons, as they now call them, of that. Did you?
No. They wanted to do the Harriet Vane, the books where he has a romance with Harriet Vane, culminating in his wedding, his marriage. And there's one more book called Busman's Honeymoon, which is quite short. But the rights for that are held by Hollywood, and the BBC couldn't afford to have them. And there is a terribly bad film with Robert Montgomery playing Peter Wimsey. And it's a very old black and white film. Very bad. Gives a bad name to early cinema, that sort of thing. I have people who complain that the series is very slow and old-fashioned, our series, but there are other people who seem to watch it on a regular basis and wear out their DVDs.
How many episodes were there?
Yes, I'm telling you, three novels. And therefore, I think, I'm right in saying, 11 or 12 episodes. So it still appears to have a following.
And the other posh bloke who really was a lawyer was the defence attorney in The Accused.
I defended the indefensible.
Lord Archer, yes.
Yes, that's what lawyers have to do. Yes, well, one couldn't tell whether he was defensible or not, because... oh, dear.
I didn't see it, I must confess.
No, well,
I didn't mind not seeing it, but having got to this stage and having read about it, I almost wish I had seen it.
Yes, well...
Probably for some of the wrong reasons.
You had seen it on a good night. And there was such good... In fact, it was an extraordinary, extraordinary thing. Because of Lord Archer's fame and notoriety, because he was already being aimed at the dock in the Old Bailey, already when the play was... And so to write a play called The Accused is a bit of a cheek, isn't it? Starring it himself as The Accused. But in the provinces, in these big theatres I was only too familiar with, we were packed out, sold out, before we got terrible reviews everywhere. But it didn't matter because they'd all booked ahead. And the audience were pin drop silences and laughter when it was required. Which I required a lot, and other people too. And it was a hit. And then we got to the Haymarket, and it was slightly more muted, but more or less the same, until the London press just tore it apart. They decided they weren't having any of this. And there, of course, the advance hadn't been... you know, a week in Birmingham is different.
Yeah.
A week in Leeds is different. Whatever it was. And so, you know, we closed after about 12 weeks.
There's also the oddity that it was a voting thing, so
yes,
the audience could vote to whether he was guilty or not.
That's why,
and the first night somewhere they went for him, and then after that everyone decided that he was innocent, which is very, very odd.
Well, it's rather torturous. Archer decided the ploy was to have the audience as the jury and to vote whether he was guilty or not. Which is fine, because he was, I forget which it was now, but he was either guilty or not guilty in the play. Whether they voted him guilty or not. And there was a certain ending which expressed that. There had to be a different ending, depending on whether he was free or locked up.
Of course, yes.
But nevertheless, the truth of the matter. But then he decided to sort of pull a fast one. So if you voted him guilty... He turned out to be not guilty. We played that ending. And the reverse. Which meant, of course, that he didn't know what... had nothing to play. There was a void at the centre of the play, which was the fact that he was neither one or the other until you said, you're that. And he said, no, I'm not, I'm that. Which was a sort of strange, nihilistic sort of puzzle that he was playing. He had a curious resemblance to Laurence Olivier, which I... very faint, but there. And I kept on thinking what Olivier would have done with the part. And he would never have consented not to having a truth to act. Says something about Archer that he somehow removed any core of truth that he could have acted. Weird. But we had a slightly stormy relationship. But again, I have little postcards to prove that he was... I used nice words like brilliant, and he would occasionally say, you've never done it better. He was 6 feet away from me, if not less, in the witness box, in the dock and in the witness box. It's a rather truncated Old Bailey. And so he would, usually at the end of the evening or the end of the act, make a comment, which might be anything from, you've never done it better, to, disgraceful. So, there we are.
Do you want to talk briefly about King Lear?
Well, I must be more resilient than I think, and I must be more optimistic than I think, because when I was young, I was offered, and productions of Hamlet were set up for me, two of them, and both of them were cancelled for various reasons, so I never played Hamlet. Then this Lear, which was going to be my 71st birthday treat in New Zealand, and I had a stroke in the rehearsal period, so I couldn't do it.
And you've recovered fully from that?
Fairly well.
You seem to have.
I went for a jog this afternoon, just a bit, and I ended up not being able to do press-ups at all, and now I can do 20 again. It's taken me some time to get back to that, which isn't bad for 75 anyway.
It's not bad for any age, I'd say.
Anyway, but, you know, you pick yourself up, you dust yourself over, and you try to carry on through the disappointment. But I met Paul Hunter when we were doing The Fantastics, who played this extraordinary fool character to my sort of... Well, the character of the old actor in The Fantastics, this famous thing that's been running on the fringes of New York for years and bombed in London, has these two wonderful parts. Mm. This completely sort of forgetful, hopeless actor who's all theatre and no reality. And his extraordinary companion. And I was worried about who this would be because I thought, how will it work? And Paul Hunter walked into the room and we did our first bits and I thought, well, this is a man who's a born clown and an absolute born. A companion in arms. It was wonderful. And
he's doing something similar at the moment on the stage at the Globe in Much Ado with Adrian Hood.
I must go and see him.
Yes, it's very good and he's having lots of fun, I suspect.
He's playing Dogberry.
Yes.
I might catch a matinee this week if it doesn't rain like it is now. But anyway, we're going to do a sort of exploration of King Lear together. We don't know quite how we're going to do it or how we're going to explore it. But the RSC is giving us backing in one of their little experimental sideline things up at Stratford or wherever. I don't know where it is.
You could end up at Hampstead in that case, which would be convenient.
Could I?
Oh, that's where they're doing the new stuff at the moment.
Oh, really?
I'm something like Dunsinane opened in Hampstead and has just gone up to Stratford now.
Oh, well. I don't know whether how much of the text we'll use and whether we'll have other actors and any musicians or whether we'll just be... I don't know. He's rather interested in the actual story of the actor turning up to rehearse Lear and then having a stroke and not being able to. Mm. But that's a rather short, sad story as opposed to a long, tragic one.
Yes.
Which is Lear.
Indeed. Okay, I think that probably is time to stop. Edward Petheridge, thank you so much.
Thank you. And now I'll face the rain and the tube to Southwark Playhouse.